And good morning, everybody. I welcome to the call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee to order for February 24th, 2022. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. Committee Legislative Assistant, Mr. Brinks, will you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
I'm here.
Nelson is present. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson present.
Carlson's present. Representative Nash.
Representative Nash is presenting a bill in another committee, so he'll be joining us shortly.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Present.
Bonner is present. Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Drazkowski is present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Elkins is present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Greenman is present. Representative Claiborne.
Claiborne present.
Claiborne is present. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick is present. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Mason is present. Representative New Brindley.
Present.
New Brindley is present. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski present.
Pawlowski is present. Representative Quam.
Present.
Quam is present. With that, Chair, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum is present. So, the next order of business is approval of the minutes from February 22nd, 2022. Representative Claiborne, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes be approved.
We got a motion to approve the minutes from 2-22-22. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are approved. And members, we have a unfortunately, Mr. Amon is going to be leaving us. He's our House DFL researcher. We have a new person on our committee, John Beeler. And if you want to unmute and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you, Mr. Beeler.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is John Beeler. I joined the House DFL as a backfill researcher with taxes and property taxes. This past year under Chair Marquardt, who I believe is in the room. And I am a New Jersey native, but please don't hold that against me. I am happy to be here in Minnesota and sharpening my shoveling skills over the past few weeks. So thank you, and I look forward to working with you all.
It sounds like from the weather report, you're going to get a more practice on that this afternoon. Anyway, with that, members, we have our agenda today. The first thing we got on our agenda is we have two campaign finance board appointees. And next Tuesday, we'll have the other two campaign finance board appointees. And hopefully we can get these confirmed at the House floor. So we have a functioning campaign finance board. So Mr. Sigurdsson, welcome to the committee. You want to introduce yourself, and then you can introduce, I think I've got Stephen Swanson first, and then David Asp. Mr. Sigurdsson, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Nelson. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the executive director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Thank you, committee members, for taking time to hear the confirmation hearing for members Asp and member Swanson. I believe you've all been provided the information packets that provides the cover letter application that the members, Mr. Asp and Mr. Swanson, made when they applied for these positions, as well as their resumes. Going to be in a brief bio on their background. And with that, I'm sure that they're ready to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Swanson, welcome to the committee. Want to give a little brief about description about yourself, and then we can get to questions. Mr. Swanson.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you this morning. My background is as a Hennepin County District Court judge and a contract administrative law judge before joining the board. In addition, I've been lucky enough to have participated in several USAID rule of law projects in other countries, including Afghanistan, Lebanon, Bosnia, and Kosovo. So I have a wide background in the judicial function mainly, but having worked in other countries to improve their judicial systems and their overall political systems, I've gained a great appreciation for our country's systems, including our separation of powers and our judicial and legislative and executive functions. Most of all, my interest in being on the campaign finance board has been that I fear that the public is losing confidence in our electoral process. And what I believe is that the more that the public knows about elections, campaigns, public officials, the more transparency is, the better they will understand the system and the more trust they will have in the system. So that's basically been my interest for being on the board. I've been on the board since July of 2017. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Swanson? Members. I see no hands popping up. With that, I will move the appointment of Stephen Swanson to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board be recommended to be confirmed. Mr. Brinks, do you want to take the role?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Joskowski.
Aye.
Joskowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleborn.
Cleborn, aye.
Cleborn votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
No.
Kosnick votes nay. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
Aye.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam votes aye. Representative Nash.
Representative Nash is excused. He's presenting a bill in another committee. He'll be with us shortly.
Thank you. With 11 ayes, 1 nay, and 1 abstain, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails, though. The recommendation is going to go to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
And the next on our agenda is the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board appointee, David Asp. Mr. Sigurdsson, do you want to do a brief introduction?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Asp is the new person in front of the committee. Member Swanson, he has not served on the board, but he has a long experience, long background in campaign finance related issues. And I'm sure that he can tell you more about his background better than I can.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Asp. If you want to give yourself a brief description and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm David Asp, the newest appointee to the Campaign Finance Board. I filled a position that was previously held by Dan Rosen. So I haven't had the chance to appear before you previously, as Judge Swanson has. But so by way of background, I am a native Minnesotan. I grew up in Moorhead, went to college at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, went to law school at the University of Minnesota Law School. And since then, in the last 17 years, apart from 1 year when I lived in Washington, D.C., after law school, I've worked in Minneapolis at the law firm Lockridge Grindall Nowen, where I was an associate and now a partner. And my legal practice has been mostly in civil litigation. As my materials indicate, I've focused on healthcare, but I've been fortunate in being able to practice in a wide variety of areas, really everything from constitutional issues to immigration law to commercial disputes. I have done some work in the campaign-related areas in litigation, and I've also worked on transactional matters. both helping nonprofits and businesses comply with the law. As I've also indicated in the materials, I've always sought to be active in my community. I have served as Representative Claiborne mentioned, I served on the Plymouth Charter Commission. I've served on the Community Action Board for Hennepin County and on the Compensation Council, where I was appointed by Chief Justice Gilday for the last two cycles. I think those experiences are relevant in that they all involved a board that had diverse perspectives, appointed by different appointing officers and serving different government functions. But I've been effective in those environments by being respectful, working together, and working toward a common goal and the common good. I've also seen political involvement as an extension of my community service, and I've volunteered for a number of campaigns, parties, and committees over the last few years. And one of the consequences of that experience is that I come to this position on the board with a great deal of respect for people who choose to run for office, and also for the people who volunteer to help people who run for office. I am aware that many of the organizations that are regulated by the board are run by volunteers, and that the process of running a campaign that's regulated by the board can in some cases be intimidating, and the laws may be in some ways counterintuitive. So with that understanding, I really do have an appreciation for the work that the board has done, and in particularly the board staff, in providing clear guidance to campaigns and other regulated entities. I think the board staff in particular has done that in a way that's nonpartisan and is focused on gaining compliance and really the intent of the rules around the campaign. Really focused on helping people to comply. So as a board member, my approach, my goal would be to continue this type of an approach. I take a nonpartisan approach to the board's work and apply the law. I don't have any particular agenda on the board. Instead, my goal would be to be fair and impartial, and really to keep an eye on providing that clear guidance for those who are regulated by the board. So that's my background and approach, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that you might have for me.
Thank you, Mr. Asp. Any questions? Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Asp, for coming before us today. I really appreciate the opportunity to have you with us today. Can you just tell me have you represented cases in the campaign finance? Certainly, I don't want you to disclose any clients. You know, confidentiality is key, so I want to keep that piece. Have you represented clients before the campaign finance board?
Mr. Asp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Claiborne, I don't believe that I've represented clients in connection with any enforcement actions by the board. I have represented clients, and I have worked with clients and represented clients in seeking guidance from the board. And so that's been my primary involvement, but that hasn't, it's been quite a few years since I've done that type of.
Representative Claiborne.
No, that's fine. I'm just curious, you know, I respect the balance of the board, right? That we need people who have leanings in both directions. It kind of keeps an eagle flying straight. So I appreciate that. But I was just curious as to whether or not you had ever challenged any of the campaign finance policies that are before us now. In your capacity as a board member, are there areas in campaign finance law that you think that we could strengthen? Or are there any areas in campaign finance that you would want up to see repealed?
Mr. Asp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Claiborne. I really can't think of anything that I would recommend legislatively at this point. I know the board does make legislative recommendations. I haven't had my first board meeting yet, so I haven't had an opportunity to be involved in that process. As I sit here today, I can't think of a particular legislative recommendation that I would make. And I would, I guess I'd add that I would view my board my role as a board member more to apply the law as it's passed by the legislature than to certainly attempt to challenge a repeal decision that you indicated.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Aspin. This will be just my last question. When you, when someone would come before you that would be in opposition to the values that you personally hold, could you just give us an example of how you would deal with such a matter?
Mr. Asp.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Clehorn. I think in the circumstances of the Campaign Finance Board, it's about applying the law clearly and fairly to all parties. And as I indicated, my goal on the board would be to set aside any particular feeling that might have an underlying issue, mm-hmm. And to focus on what the rule is as defined by the legislature.
Thank you very much, Mr. Asp. I appreciate your answers, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Asp, appreciated your comments and specifically recognizing that most of the people that fall under the Campaign Finance Board regulations are volunteers. I think that's an important distinction to make and recognize. But could you talk a little bit more about your feelings about being on the board and using it as kind of advocacy? And to advocate for greater democracy or anything like that. What are your feelings on that?
Mr. Asp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick. I don't believe I mentioned that, and I don't really view the board as an advocacy position. I think the board has a neutral function in applying the law as it's created by the legislature. So I don't believe that there's an advocacy role as a board member in the way that you've described it.
Representative Kosnick.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Asp. Thank you for that answer. That's I concur with that and kind of the sentiment that I think is important to Campaign Finance Board members. I look forward to supporting you. Thanks.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Asp. And I also just want to echo what Representative Kosnick said, which is I really do appreciate really thinking about all of those folks, and not just candidates, but the volunteer treasurers and all of the people who I think make our campaigns run. And I think we have a good system that allows grassroots, volunteer-driven state campaigns. And I appreciate that you're coming and looking at it like that. One question I have is I think one of the things that often happens with laws that are sometimes, 20, 30 years on the books is just the need to clarify. And in many cases, the Campaign Finance Board has rulemaking authority. And I'm wondering what you think about using rulemaking authority to clarify and to sort of provide clarity and precision for the candidates and the treasurers and all of those folks who may be stuck with rules that were either written 30 years ago and the campaigns have changed or just aren't super clear.
Mr. Asp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman. Without thinking about a particular rule, it's difficult for me to answer how I would treat it. So I guess my approach would be to look generally at what the rule does and how it would change something that exists. And if I don't think it's a role of rules, for example, to change a provision of the statute, if that would have to come from the legislature. But if there's another rule that, for example, is outdated, then I think the board should look at reviewing it to update it to make it consistent with practice. Or if there's a way that rules can be revised to bring more clarity, I think that's an important function of the board. As I indicated, one of the values that I have is providing clear guidance. I think that for those folks who are complying and who are regulated by the board, understanding clearly what the rules are is critical. So that's an important value that I have, but I would certainly be aware of the limits on the board and rulemaking as well.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. And I think clarity and I appreciate the view going in that a big piece of the role of the board is providing that clarity and ensuring that folks can comply with the laws that we write. And I just to what I wanted to clarify is, you know, sometimes the statutes as written when they were written are actually not that clear are not clear as it relates to the way modern campaigns are run. And so I do think rulemaking is an important tool that the board has, that the six board members have, in order to create some of that clarity and precision. And so I wanted to make sure that was a tool that you were comfortable using in places where obviously we both agree that we write the laws and the campaign finance board enforce and clarifies the laws, but I just wanted to clarify that. So is that what I heard you say, that you're comfortable using rulemaking in places where you think it will add precision and clarity to statutes that have already been written?
Mr. Asp, I think that might be a yes or no question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman. I think the answer is yes to that. As I indicated, I think there's a role for rulemaking, and I'm comfortable looking at rules in that context.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. S.
And Representative Nash, welcome back to the committee. I hope your bill went well in capital investments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They say it was fantastic, as all Nash bills are, as you know. And to Mr. Asp, I notice over your shoulder there is a poster about baseball, which is one of my favorite games. And many of us complain quite often about for lack of a better term, calling it a hometown umpire, because they can't necessarily call balls and strikes for both teams fairly. And in your role as a potential member of the campaign finance board, would you agree that you would be an umpire that calls balls and strikes consistently for either side of an aisle's candidate or situation, and not allow any particular personal viewpoints to come into how you might rule?
Mr. Asp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. I would generally agree with that. And I think, as I kind of indicated earlier in response to Representative Greenman's question, value clarity. And one of the things about having clear rules is that it's the same standard that applies to all parties.
Representative Nash.
And Mr. Chair, that's exactly what I was hoping to hear, that a ball is a ball and a strike is a strike. And that's exactly, I think, what we are looking for in people who we put into the campaign finance role that we're talking about today. And that's a question that I've asked of all people that come before us for the years that I've been here at the legislature. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Nash. And thank you, Mr. Asp. You had the pleasure of getting more questions because Mr. Swanson has been before us before, even this last year he was before us. And so that's probably why there was more questions for you, because it's the first time we've seen you. And with that, members, I will move that the appointment of David Asp for the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board be recommended to be confirmed. Members, Mr. Brinks, will you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson pass.
Carlson passes. Representative Nash.
Nash, aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Joskowski.
Aye.
Joskowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley. Representative New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski, aye.
Pulaski votes aye. Representative Quam.
I believe Representative Quam is Capital Investments presenting a bill right now. So
Thank you.
You'll be excused.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Carlson, pass.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, with a vote of 11 ayes, the motion prevails.
Motion prevails. The recommendation's on its way to the House floor. Thank you, gentlemen, and thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Thank you for your time. With that, members, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda, which is House File 3035. Representative Hornstein's the author. I will move to refer House File 3035 to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate your hearing this bill. House File 3035 addresses the issue of cost overruns and delays related to the Southwest Light Rail Transit Project, otherwise known as the Green Line Extension. It's a light rail line that will connect downtown Minneapolis and Eden Prairie. The background of this bill dates back to this past summer when an initial cost overrun of $200 million was announced, and that was appropriated by Hennepin County. This project is funded jointly by the federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, and Hennepin County. At that time, myself and Senator Dibble grew very concerned about this cost overrun and a pattern of several overruns and delays that had taken place associated with this project. So at that time, which was late July of this past summer, we asked the legislative auditor to do a special review of the pattern of cost overruns and delays. The legislative auditor indicated to us they didn't have the capacity to do a full review, but they did a summary document that indicated some concerns on their part related to project management. And so that memo, approximately 30 pages of very solid and good research, as we've come to expect from the legislative auditor, prompted us to really look carefully at legislation, because given the fact that this is the largest infrastructure project in state history, and then that we have encountered a pattern of delays and cost overruns and potential management issues, we decided to come forward with this bill. Of course, this would be a part of the legislative directives to the legislative auditor for their agenda coming up in the next year. I recognize, Mr. Chair and members, that this is an unusual circumstance to have a bill asking for an audit. We do have, of course, the Legislative Audit Commission process, which is commencing this week. But given the urgency of this matter, given the very specific nature of the items that we would like the legislative auditor to investigate, which are outlined in this bill, we thought that a special review and a program evaluation together would be appropriate. And again, given the fact that this is something that is not typically done, although it's not without precedent, we have checked with the appropriate legislators on the Audit Commission, both the chair and the vice chair. In our case, in the House, it's Vice Chair Hansen. We have vetted this language with the auditor, and we do feel that the auditor is very appropriate to conduct this review, given the fact that the auditor is known for excellent and objective work and research. We felt this was appropriate. And finally, Mr. Chair and members, there is an appropriation of $200,000 from the general fund. This is because there are many technical and engineering issues involved in this audit, and we believe that the legislative auditor should have the resources to hire outside experts to assist them in their evaluation, and this is why there is an appropriation. So, members, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I ask for your support.
And members on my list, I've got Judy Randall from the Legislative Auditors the legislative auditor here to answer questions. She indicated she doesn't need to testify. So we'll go to direct to question, members' questions. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, thanks for bringing this bill. I remember back to a time in the Transportation Committee when I brought a bill to remove the state from the funding stream on Southwest Light Rail. And it passed into law. I think I remember you saying some complimentary words to it. And this has been a very troublesome project from the very beginning. And I think that this audit is a reasonable request. I just think that this has been probably one of the worst executed, run, funded, managed projects that may be in the top 10 in the U.S. history. But one of my questions was for Ms. Randall as our new OLA. Is this something that, based on the timelines that is being asked of you, that you have the capacity to get done in the timeline that is being requested?
Ms. Randall, if you want to identify yourself for the record, and then you can proceed with your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, legislative auditor. Thanks for having me here today. Thank you, Representative Nash, for the question. Yes, I think the way the bill is laid out, it sets forth a couple of different avenues for us to conduct work and examine things that have gone on with Southwest Light Rail. As Representative Hornstein mentioned, there's kind of two approaches here laid out in the bill. One is a special review. As you may know, those tend to be more narrowly focused on really specific complaints and concerns. We have already initiated that. We have sent a letter to the Metropolitan Council asking a series of questions and are waiting for information back. So that we are kind of expediting and, you know, are trying to move forward with information as quickly as possible for the legislature and the public. Regarding the request to do a program evaluation, the way the language is worded is it does funnel it through the Legislative Audit Commission and request them to select the program evaluation as a topic for us to evaluate this year, which is the appropriate way to handle that. As I think you know, the Legislative Audit Commission is the authority that does direct the office to conduct those program evaluations. And as you know, because you know our work, those do take longer. And so a program evaluation would look more broadly at kind of management, decisions along the way, especially related to the route and other aspects of the whole project. And so that report would come out really at the beginning of next session. So that would be a longer term project. But I think that timeline is, sorry for my dog, that timeline is contemplated and understood in the bill.
It sounds like your puppy's giving a political comment. Or Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say, Ms. Randall, thank you for the work that you've always done. And much like your predecessor, my friend, Mr. Nobles, you soft sell everything by saying, yes, I think we can do that. And you usually under promise and over deliver. And I am looking forward to this. And I will just point out that in the history of my 8 years here at the Capitol, this may be, I think, number 3 or 4 of things that Representative Hornstein and I agree on. So I think this is a much needed request. This project is a debacle. It has been managed so poorly, and the people of Minnesota and the people, thanks to the bill that I passed, of Hennepin County are paying outrageous amounts of money for something that is really just a bad project. And whether you like light rail or don't like light rail, as we begin voting on this, members, put yourself in the position of sort of an overseer of finances and direction of scrutiny on that. This has gone largely unscrutinized, and I think that as legislators, this is a very good thing for us to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What's the saying, Representative Nash? Even a broken clock is right twice a day.
Representative, is that for Representative Hornstein or for me, Mr. Chair?
I have just a comment. It doesn't need any. Representative Elkins, you have quite your hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I agree that this audit is necessary and timely. Right now, we're caught up in the middle of an epidemic of finger pointing, which is unproductive. The project does need to proceed and to completion, but how we do that and first requires an understanding of how we got here in the first place. And I think that an OLA audit is an essential key to allowing us to establish a baseline on how to proceed from here and what changes need to be made in the project management and the execution of the project in order to enable it to succeed. So thank you very much, Chair Hornstein, for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I didn't hear a question there. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Chair Hornstein. It's fun to hear one of your bills in a committee outside of transportation. So welcome to the committee. And my question is what are your thoughts on, I agree that this is a good transparency, dig into the issue bill to take a look at it. Taxpayers throughout Minnesota are extremely concerned, if not upset and outright livid about the overruns and the cost of this project. But my question is, and I think I know what I feel on it, is why aren't we using Met Council dollars to do this project rather than general fund dollars of all the taxpayers? Because it is upon the Met Council to operate and manage this project. And my only concern is we should use their dollars. There are plenty of federal dollars coming into them. And it almost makes it a little bit even more painful for the general taxpayers to use general fund dollars rather than existing dollars that the Met Council has. What are your thoughts on that, Mr. Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the question, Representative Kosnick. I understand where you're coming from, but I think that we want to make this as direct and clean as possible in terms of a legislatively directed appropriation from the state general fund. I think once we start getting into Met Council funding things, I think that we want this to be objective and understandable, that this is something coming at the legislature's direction and funded through, dollars that we are in control of. So I think just for trust and transparency, it would be very unusual for someone who is being the subject of the audit to be having any direct financial involvement with the audit. So I think this makes it clearer. And I also think that this is a relatively small allocation of money simply for a very direct and understandable purpose, which is technical expertise that the auditor has requested.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. Well, Chair Hornstein, I appreciate your comments on that and won't belabor the point. I think you're articulated a fair position. And I appreciate you taking this bill, leading with this, and it does have bipartisan support from members of the Transportation Committee, especially. And so thank you for doing that. I would, it's just a painful thing for taxpayers to look at all the way around, and it can't be understated. So I look forward to seeing what the results are from the audit, and hopefully we can learn from it for future projects and get this project back on the right tracks.
Thank you. Representative Brindley, I see you have your hand up. Welcome to the committee this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is actually sort of related. Obviously, Representative Hornstein, thank you for the bill. Everyone agrees, I think, that this needs to be done. I don't think there's any question. In fact, I really appreciate particularly all four transportation leaders, I think, are on board, which is a really good thing. My question is, as I review the fiscal note, it looks like Ms. Randall was consulted on the fiscal note, and yet there is an indication of no costs outside of what is already available. And so I'm wondering why you still did why there is still an appropriation, even though the office is saying they do not need additional funds.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you for the question, Representative Brindley, and I do appreciate that you pointed out that both the chairs of the respective committees in the House and Senate and ranking members are on board with this. I meant to say that. So thank you, Representative Brindley, for bringing that one out. You know, this was really, I when we had an initial conversation, and we can have Ms. Randall comment, it was really something that myself and Senator Dibble, you know, raised, because we recognize the technical nature of this, that, you know, there are, you know, engineers on both sides of the question, right, and construction experts on both sides of the question. And so if there was a need to have, again, a third party look at this, under the direction of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, we wanted to be sure that those resources were available. And so that's why we put that in. It was, you are correct, Representative Brindley, that I think initially there wasn't necessarily a request from the auditor. It was something that myself and Senator Dibble raised as a, you know, something that we, again, crossing the T's and dotting the I's of this bill, we didn't want to leave the legislative auditor without any access to expertise, just to make sure that we do the best possible job with this audit.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering then if Ms. Randall would suggest a new fiscal note then. If the office does think they need some additional funds, it seems that we should have maybe a revised fiscal note. Otherwise, I know we in the legislature, I get concerned. I think that we need to be concerned. We often talk about the change in the couch cushions around here, right? Which this would certainly be. I mean, I understand it's not a large appropriation. I just have concern when the office is actually telling us that they don't need anything, and we still just want to spend money. And so that's my concern. But obviously support the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Brindley. Thank you for paying attention to the details in that way. I do appreciate it. You know, we can do a lot of the work with our existing resources. As I said, we've already started a special review, and if the Audit Commission selects this as a program evaluation topic, then, you know, we have existing resources for that. So that was why we said this could cost us nothing. If, and, you know, as we're kind of going through the legislative process, I'm getting a better handle on how deeply members want us to dive into the technical aspects, as Representative Hornstein said, if that is an interest in the direction we go for either the special review, more likely the program evaluation, then we likely would need to hire a consultant for some of that large project management expertise, right? We are not structural engineers. We're not, you know, we don't do these big projects every day. I do, frankly, have a little concern about being able to find a consultant who is independent, who isn't somehow involved with this project. And so I'm a little apprehensive about committing to hire a consultant, because I'm just not sure we'll be able to find one that's independent, that meets our standards of independence. And so we're hedging a little bit, I guess, is what you're seeing there in the fiscal note. I think we can do a really valuable, insightful job for you without hiring a consultant. If the legislature wants us to go deeper, we're happy to do that. You know, we will find a consultant out there somewhere to help us. And so then, you know, we can use the money for that. So I know that's not a straight answer. We can revise the fiscal note if you'd like us to say, you know, we plan to do technical work and therefore, you know, would use the $200,000 for that. That's an easy change to do. And I'm happy to work with Ms. Roberts on that. If that, you know, kind of makes the whole thing more copacetic for the committee, we're happy to do that. Thank you.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you so much, Ms. Randall. I appreciate that. And certainly I appreciate why that might be necessary. Just as a matter of process and procedure in the House, you know, when we get a fiscal note, that matters to us. And when it says there's no cost, then it seems odd that there would be an appropriation. So, just as a matter of procedure, it seems, Representative Horstein, like we might want to get that cleaned up and have accurate accounting along the way there. Thanks so much, though. I certainly intend to support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Brindley. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In our recent LAC meeting, this did come up, and several of us voiced it's sort of a key audit thing to look at examples where something has huge overruns or the estimates were off. But every audit is not the same, even into the same department. They vary from a sampling where they will, for instance, take a few weeks or a month or two of expenditures by MDH and analyze to a full-blown audit. We have some expertise in IT and different areas, but again, the difficulty varies. So being precise on the fiscal note is a bit of a challenge, especially since if we as legislators pick an audit topic and it's done through that process, it's part of the system. It's part of the auditor's program and budget. When committees, which has often been done over the years, decide to add something special, then it's often additional fundings are there because of the specialty and detail of the audit. So I know it seems like, well, we're just asking for an audit, but that isn't, doesn't explain it enough. And even when we vote for, as legislators, an audit, the audit committee goes through and helps refine it as to, the detail, what part, and et cetera, before it's done. So it is sometimes easier for a committee to say, here are the details, here is what we want done, and then they add the funds for a consultant or additional resources that have to be called upon. And as always, the prime thing for the audit is not being, take out any biased. It's the numbers and it's the details. And, frankly, most of these large construction projects, the people that are in the know are employed by the entities doing these type of projects. So I like that Frank is bringing this forward. I hope that there's a great deal of clarity and detail of how the audit should be done when this bill gets passed and through. It'll make it much more simpler, and it gives us a bit of a heads up on what outside resources would have to be added to that effort. So I want to thank the author. Thank you.
I didn't hear a question there. Representative Elkins, you have a question, and then we'll get to a vote.
Yeah, I just have some clarifying information that I think might be helpful to you. So based on what I've learned about the project and where we are right now, I think it's highly likely that the auditor is going to need access to a geotechnical engineer. A lot of the finger pointing that's going on relates to who should have known what when about the soil conditions in the Kenilworth corridor. And the hardest part for Ms. Randall's team is going to be able to find a geotechnical engineer that does not have longstanding business ties to either the engineering consultancy or the construction consultancy, because that's where a lot of the finger pointing is going on right now.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I guess any further questions or comments? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 3035 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Brinks, will you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson. Representative Nash.
Nash votes aye.
Nash votes aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Joskowski. Joskowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleborn.
Cleborn aye.
Cleborn votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley. New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski votes aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam votes aye. Chair, with a vote of 13 ayes, the motion prevails.
Thank you. The motion prevails. The bill's on its way to the Ways and Means Committee. Look at the right line on my script here. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Thank you, Ms. Randall. And we'll go on to our next bill. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 3557, Representative Marquardt's bill, and I'll make a motion to refer this bill to the General Register. And Representative Marquardt, welcome to the committee, Chair Marquardt, and please explain your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing House File 3557. What this does is expands the use for legal expenditure for terminating committees. And before I go any further, I've worked with the Campaign Finance Board as a candidate for 22 years, and I have to thank the board, Mr. Sigerson, for the professionalism. I've had many questions over the years, and it's always been dealt with so professionally and promptly, and I've just really appreciated that. So right now, if you want to terminate your committee, you've got to get down to $100 in either cash or capital assets. And so your capital assets could be things like computers or printers or rebar. By the way, if anyone's interested in 5'3" thick rebar, I've got some for sale. You've got to be able to sell it at a fair market price. So I'll be terminating. So if you need rebar, I have some. So anyway, and also with cash, you have to get down to $100 or less, and then you file a termination report with the board. As far as cash, you can pay off bills, you can contribute to other state candidates or party units and so forth. You can't give to federal or local candidates. You can transfer the dollars to another committee. But one point is that you can, especially if you're dissolving within 12 months, you can give an unlimited amount to a charity, a 501c3 under the IRS rules. And so what this bill does, it says or includes and adds that if you're a terminating committee and dissolving within the next 12 months, that you could give an unlimited amount to school boards. So, and school boards, and talking to research and that, would not be individuals, it would be the school board overall. So why? And I have to say, for full disclosure, I am terminating a committee this year, but I don't plan for this use. So I don't have a dog in this fight, but this was brought to me. And I got thinking about it that, you know, here's a terminating committee I can give to a charity of my choice, which could be almost any cause or issue. But there might not be anything available if I wanted to give to help students, you know, somehow through the school. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you've got this elected board that would then distribute the money out to a school. Now, this bill only refers to schools, but, you know, maybe it could also include city councils and county commission and township board. So, that's the main gist of the bill, is that, and I don't know what the history might be behind this, but if I can give to a charity unlimited, I'm going to dissolve within the last 12 months, to basically any cause, I should also be able to give to students if that's a cause of mine also. So, members, that's the bill, and I'm open to questions.
And thank you, Chair Marquardt. And we have question, Mr. Zeke Sigurdsson is still here. He's can answer and help with any questions. I don't believe he wants to testify unless I'm wrong there. He can speak up. I don't see him jumping up. So I've got questions from a couple members. Representative New Brindley, you're first on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Marquardt. My question would just be, certainly I understand the spirit behind this, giving it to the school board for the students. Currently, it could be given to the students through a PTO or something like that, right? I mean, there is still a mechanism in place right now. They would fall under a charitable contribution, I assume, right? And it could go through that avenue to get to students as well.
Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley, yes. I mean, if you had a PTO or let's say a booster club, for example, that was organized as a 501c3, you could, absolutely. But that might not exist where they're set up, or there might not be a group like that or set up as a 501c3. So yes, otherwise, yeah, that would be a possibility.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Marquardt.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Marquardt, we've talked about this before, about the money being given to the school board. And the way I would interpret it, or could be interpreted, is that the school board has its own expenses versus giving it to the school district as a whole gives a lot more opportunities. So can you, and I know you're going to look into it, so just checking to see what you found out.
Chair Marquardt. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mason. Yes, I did do some checking and in talking with education folks and so forth, and house research. And I mean, a school board, first of all, would not include individuals. So, you know, there's one thought is, you know, would that be given into an individual school board member? And that would not be the case. A school board is the governing body. And while there's no specific definition, it would be the governing body. So you would be giving it basically to the governing body that, you know, makes those decisions on how to distribute funds for the school.
Representative Mason.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while I was on the school board, it wasn't for the 16 years that one of our peers has been on it, but I'm trying to think of a mechanism other than the structured mechanism of a booster organization or someone set up to collect donations. And I can't think of, you know, the correct mechanism for the board itself to take a, you know, donated funds. I was the treasurer on the board for a while, and it was very particular of sourcing and expenditure of funds. There were dedicated buckets for spending on this area and that area. And I understand the intent, but I think it, especially for some school boards, may be a little bit difficult or complicating. And I think the current statute allows for contributing money to the appropriate portion of a school entity to be able to handle it under you know, state law and the statutes pertaining to school boards. So I like the intent. I think that it'd be somewhat redundant with the intent and somewhat problematic without changing portions of school statutes. So I guess I'm not looking at this as being something we should proceed with without further clarification or details from the author. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kwan. That's a great question. I know when I was on a city council, there are some restrictions on just taking contributions. And so I don't know what the law would be. I don't know if anyone research would be here to know what the law might be at school boards taking donations. I'm not sure of that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to bring that point up and see if there was enlightenment from the author that could clarify. I still think that we have some fog and chalk dust on the issue. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Marquardt, I certainly understand and appreciate your desire to help with campaign funds going to a different avenue than it might. But I also know that there are a number of other avenues to dispose of campaign funds that can eventually impart benefit to local folks. I have to think that local Lions clubs or other civic organizations could receive something to dispose of that. And I, again, I appreciate your intent and your heart here, but I just don't think that this is something that I can support. I think it also brings some politicization into the arena. You know, most of these organizations try to be nonpartisan, but I think that this just maybe adds something to that mix that isn't something that we're going to want to support. So again, I appreciate your desire here, but I will be voting no.
Any further questions?
Yep, Mr. Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Now, this bill was brought to me, and like I said, I'm not planning to do this, but I do think there might be questions. And it may not be, I'm going to admit, may not be, as I've listened to some of this, be ready for prime time. And so if the committee would be willing to lay that over, I'd be okay with that.
That's fine. Representative Marquardt, is that your wrap up, or do you have you want to wrap up? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, other than that, I do have 5-foot length rebar, 3/8 inch. Some of it's bent because it's windy out in West Central Minnesota, but no, that's it. And I mean, I think this is an issue that we should talk more about ultimately, you know, and about, you know, what is, should there be expanded uses for these funds, especially if there's certain areas of charitable contributions you can make, but you know, cities and counties and that, they have uses for, and I don't know if we want to expand there or not, but members, I appreciate listening to this, and I would entertain a motion if you would table this at this time.
Well, with that, members, with the author's desire and with some of the questions brought up and some work that may need to be done on this, I'm going to lay this bill over, and if we get answers to those questions, we may bring it up at a later date. Thanks, Representative Marquardt, for your time, and thank you for your presentation.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Well, the last bill we have on our agenda is House File 2683, Representative Druskowski, and I'll move the bill to have it in front of us. The intent is just to lay this over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Druskowski, you want to present your bill, and then we've got some testifiers here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 2683 requires registered lobbyists to file a statement of economic interest no more than 5 days after they became a registered lobbyist. During their time as a lobbyist, they will be required to submit a new statement of economic interest every January. Elected legislators are currently required to do this every year. The 3-page economic interest statement is simple and uncomplicated. When filling the document out, individuals are required to disclose their income, source of income, and any other financial relationships or special payments they have received in the last year. Legislators are required to fill this document out because the voters have a right to know who is making payments to their elected officials. This is done to prevent our public servants from receiving money in unethical ways that could lead to a conflict of interest or corruption. House File 2683 would simply extend this very basic common sense disclosure requirement to the influential lobbyists that work in Minnesota. Whether we like it or not, hundreds of lobbyists descend on St. Paul every legislative session to try and change laws and enact their own agenda. Often these lobbyists are doing the work on behalf of massive corporations, powerful law firms, and other government entities. The lobbyists' work on behalf of these entities will inevitably affect every Minnesotan. As such, I believe the public has a right to know who is paying these lobbyists and what kind of compensation these lobbyists are receiving. As I said earlier, this is a simple and common sense step that frankly is only the bare minimum standard. Connecticut has a very similar law which requires lobbyists to file an annual report in January, which must include detailed information on the compensation they receive. New York requires registered lobbyists to file bi-monthly reports, which must include information about the compensation paid or owed to the lobbyist. The purpose behind House File 2683 is simple. Make Minnesota state government more transparent and honest. Everyday Minnesotans do not have the time to go through hundreds of pages of campaign finance documents in an effort to follow the money that is influencing their state. However, requiring lobbyists to fill out a statement of economic interest would give voters a straightforward, easy, and streamlined way of seeing who is being compensated, what kind of compensation is being received, and whose interests are being represented. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll stand for questions after the rest of the testimony.
And I have a list of testifiers here. The first person on my list is Matt Dean, former House member. Welcome back to the legislature, and please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to see you all again. And my name is Matt Dean, and I'm just here representing myself as a former House member in committed long-term recovery and a concerned citizen on this House file. This testimony is for informational purposes only and doesn't reflect the opinions of my employers. So I just want to say that. Representative Draskowski reached out to me kind of as he was researching this bill. Looking back to the last time we kind of addressed this, which was in House rules several years back, dealing with basically member protection and staff protection around issues with lobbying. I tried to rack my brain and look back, and I pulled up NCSL and looked for a 50 state comparison to see kind of where we fit in. There's about 35 states that are basically like us. And then there's some folks, some states at either end. And I think because of our lobbyist gift ban in particular, I think we kind of have a prairie home companion view of this, where women are strong, our men are good looking, all our children are above average, and we're beyond reproach and don't need any help with that. But actually, there are some gaps, I think, that could be improved with lobbying to kind of streamline some of the requirements that we do have, actually cut some red tape. And I think that there are also some things that we could do to improve. I think the MGRC does a great job of fostering professionalism and accountability at the Capitol. Legislators can rely on lobbyists to help them understand legislation. And I learned as a freshman that lobbyists can provide excellent feedback and support of both sides of an issue, and they do, by and large, a great job. MGRC also has the ability to discipline members and an internal control, which I think is great. But one of the things that we ran into from members is that not all lobbyists are members of the coalition and are outside of that. And there's also two pieces of it that I think are holes, one of which that came from member complaints, one of which was the fact that if folks are involved in litigation, that they could be, if you're suing an entity, whether it's governmental or non-governmental, that you have a large vested interest in the outcome of that. And sometimes that particular legislation was being pushed basically as a means of discovery for a private lawsuit. And that is really not fair to our staff in the state, and it's not fair to the members that they don't know that be disclosed. Representative Draskowski's bill doesn't take on that portion, which we looked at, but it does look at the other portion, which is if a lobbyist were to have a vested interest in the outcome of a vote based on personal investment. So this is a fictitious example, but let's say, for example, that someone owned a $3 million building that was going to be purchased, let's say by Minsky, and somebody was lobbying in support of that bill who owned that building. That's something that has a big impact on the outcome of a vote that really legislators should know about. And that also just having an equity stake in those pieces, I think legislators, if you have to find out if somebody got paid $5,000 to lobby on something, obviously if somebody were to stand to make thousands, tens of thousands or even more on the outcome of a vote, members should know that too. So those are kind of the two gaps we looked at earlier. This bill addresses one. I think that there could be at least a minimum of disclosure in certain instances as a, almost like a conflict of interest that a member would have if they brought forward if a bill was coming up before the legislature that you would disclose. So I think there's some opportunities to improve and tighten the disclosure from lobbyists that would protect members and also protect staff from having to do work that really they shouldn't be doing it because it's a private gain. And so that was the protection members that the protection measures that we looked at a few years ago when we changed the House rules. So when Representative Drazkowski gave me a call, I said I would rack my brain and try to do a little digging back in my memory. And that's the history behind it. So with that, members, I'd be happy to entertain any questions. And thank you for your time. And look forward to seeing you again.
And members, we got, you know, 9:41. We have to be out of here at 10. A reminder that this is going to be laid on the table. So if the testifiers, if you can limit your testimony and as we go forward here. I have on the list here an Anastasia Belladonna Correa. I don't see her on the call. The next person I have on my list then is Abby Breidach. Welcome to the committee, and you want to state your name for the record. You know the gig.
You know the drill.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I apologize for being kind of janky here on my phone. I'm running a webinar at the same time. But so my name is Abby Breidach, and I am testifying to you today as the president of the Minnesota Government Relations Council. MGRC is a network of roughly 500 lobbyists in Minnesota whose common goal is to influence the public policy process through ethical representation. For over 40 years, legislators and state officials have relied on credible information they receive from MGRC members. I'm here to share concerns with House File 2683, which, as mentioned, would require registered lobbyists to file an economic interest statement. You, as elected officials, are all familiar with this requirement. These statements disclose an official's source of income, financial holdings, non-homesteaded real estate, and interest in horse racing. Eric Hyland will follow me to share some general comments about applying this standard to private citizens, but I will share how this standard would affect someone with my type of position. Besides being the MGRC president, I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association, and only a portion of my job consists of lobbying the legislature. Like other association directors who lobby, most of my job relates to association management, member services, events, construction, technical support, and running webinars. If this were to pass, I would likely choose not to register as a lobbyist to avoid disclosure of my personal finances, and would then fall into the gray area of educator by not commenting on specific legislation. I believe that many others would choose this route, which would result in less transparency and regulation, the opposite of what I assume this bill hopes to achieve. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Breidach. Mr. Hyland, welcome to the committee. Again, state your name for the tape. You know the drill, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Eric Hyland, and today I'm also representing the Minnesota Government Relations Council. I've been a registered lobbyist and a member of MGRC for 25 years, and I'm also proud to be a past president of this organization. MGRC opposes House File 2683. The bill requires lobbyists to file the very same statement of economic interest, that are currently required to be filed by public officials. This is simply inappropriate and unnecessary. As all of you know, legislators and other public officials must file statements because they have, by election or appointment, been bestowed the awesome responsibility to protect the public interest and public funds. The purpose of these filings is obvious: to create public confidence that the people actually making decisions on behalf of the public are doing so without financial gain. Lobbyists are not public officials. We do not make decisions on behalf of the public. Lobbyists are private individuals who represent clients who are exercising their First Amendment constitutional right to petition their government. In short, lobbyists represent private interests. As lobbyists, we already disclose our economic interests. We must report 2 times a year that we are in fact being compensated by our clients, and our clients must report how much they spend influencing government, including the amount of money they spend compensating lobbyists. There are plenty of disclosures that lobbyists and our clients already make in order to exercise their constitutional protected rights. Thank you for giving Abby and I the opportunity to testify, and we're both available to answer any questions.
With that, and I don't see, like I said, I don't see Miss Belladonna Correa here. Members, questions of the testifiers, questions of the author. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And I think I share your interest in ensuring that we have both disclosure and transparency of who's at the Capitol, of how we're making our decisions. I think that that's why we have economic interest statements. My question, and I actually have some questions about how this bill does that, because I think what you said is we want to know who's paying them and what compensation are they receiving. And I think that that's right. We want to know if there's lobbyists in front of us, we want to know who they're representing. We want to know who's compensating them for it. My understanding is that's why we have our current regime of they register if they're spending over $3,000. So we have a relatively low bar. We want people to register. We want to ensure that they're registering. I'm wondering how you think that having them disclose their private interests unrelated to the lobbying will further transparency and what sort of legitimate government interests that serves.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. You know, we don't know whether those interests would be related to their lobbying or not. Sometimes it may be, sometimes it may not be. You know, if they're lobbying on behalf of, the next football stadium that is going to be built in, 30 years from now, God forbid. And they've got some sort of interest in that football stadium. I think we as legislators want to know that. I think our constituents want to know that. I think overall, the lobbyists that I see here at the Capitol are very professional. I think most of them do a good job of representing their interests, but also telling you the other side of the issue too, so you can get a full circled understanding of the issue. And, you ask the lobbyists, well, what would the other side say? If I'm a lobbyist and I've got a $30,000 interest in the outcome of a particular bill that's unrelated to the direct lobbying, or might be related to the direct lobbying effort that I'm doing on behalf of whoever's hiring me, I may act differently. I may not, Representative Greenman, I might not tell you all of the details on the other side of the argument or all of the history about it in order to increase the chances that the bill would pass or fail, depending on what the position is. So I think sunlight is the best disinfectant when we look at the public arena, whether it's legislators, lobbyists, and the things that go on here. I think we owe it to our constituents to bring the transparency that will will bring honesty and integrity to what we do here. I don't think we can have enough of that. And so that's what the bill aims to do. I don't know if I answered you, Representative Greenman, directly, but thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jaskowski. I think part of what I'm getting at is we are getting this, I think, gets pretty close to a constitutional line. I think that the standard is, and I would probably have to ask Matt Gearing, but is that it's substantially related to a government's valid interest. And I think when it comes to people being paid by another interest to come petition us, I think that that's clear, and we have laws around that, and I'm interested if I'd be interested in working with you to strengthen those if there's a way to do that. I think when we get to people's private interests, lobbyists don't give up their First Amendment rights just by becoming lobbyists. And so we have lots of people who come to us to advocate on behalf of something that they may have a financial interest, may have a personal interest in. That's sort of what the First Amendment protects in petitioning the democracy, their government. And so I guess what I worry about with this bill is by requiring folks who lobby, already require them to lobby on who they're representing, but requiring them to disclose, and we all did an economic interest statement, it requires you to disclose your homestead, any sort of individualized investments you have. And I think we're creeping really close to, and maybe going over a constitutional line, meant to protect what I think we all agree on is we want citizens to be able to come and advocate for positions. We want stakeholders, we want people who have an interest in, you know, their communities or whatever to come. And we need to hear all of those voices. But I just worry that we're really close to the constitutional line by not tailoring it to the thing that I think we should be worried about, which is who they represent. And who they're speaking for, and making sure that the public and lawmakers understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Claiborne, and then I have Representative Nash. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say thank you to Ms. Brydock for raising the issue of lobbyists telling us who they are, but the educators who are out there that we don't know much about. And I think it's an important distinction about who's being paid and what they're doing. And I just want to make sure that I say thank you to her for raising that issue. Representative Jaskowski, I appreciate where you're going with this. I too have some constitutional concerns about it, but I appreciate the fact that you are calling us to all be accountable for where the money is coming from and who's paying and who's benefiting. And I do think that we have to look at our own behavior as legislators to make sure that we are always as transparent as possible and what we are doing and who's backing us and who's paying for educating the public about us. So I just want to say thank you for bringing the topic of clean elections forward and making sure that money is that we are all as transparent as possible about where support is coming and where who's paying and who's benefiting. But as for the lobbyists, I think the fact that they are registered lobbyists, we all know that they're lobbyists. I think that's a really important distinction in the law. Thank you.
I didn't hear a question there. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the intent, but I have a question that I can maybe direct towards Ms. Brydock. Ms. Brydock, when you register as a lobbyist or one of your members registers as a lobbyist, either for a new client or, you know, expanding an existing client, can you talk about the number of things that has to happen to disclose who they are, what they pay you, and what happens as after that contract is initiated? Because I just want to make sure that my understanding is what the reality is.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, for the question. I'll be honest, I've had the same job for a while, so I haven't registered as a new client. There are several different disclosures that we provide throughout the year of, and some of which have been amended recently, but to acknowledge how much we spend on lobbying as an association, how much we're paid as a separate lobbyist. I have a contract lobbyist, so I have to disclose how much they're being paid. But, and personally, because of my association job. You can look up my salary if you want on the 990 report, and that's another way that association lobbyists function. But I would actually ask if we could ask Mr. Highland this. He's a contract lobbyist, and he has a lot more experience with adding new clients in those disclosures. Mr. Chair, if you would like to ask him, I think he
Mr. could. Mr. Highland, if you can give some light to this thing, and I see Mr. Sigurdsson's got his hand up. So Mr. Highland.
Yeah, and Mr. Sigurdsson can help me out here too. But the lobbyists are required to follow to register for each client, disclose what topics they are working on, and then as Ms. Breidach mentioned, we are required to kind of itemize twice a year for each client the amount of money that we spend influencing government. And in this context, it's, you know, what kind of expenses do you have? Phone, parking, travel. And you have to do that for every single client. Every client in return has to file principal reports to the board. And all of those are of course publicly available. It's an issue that, as Abby mentioned, for those of us who have multiple clients, it's not an insignificant burden.
Mr. Sigurdsson, maybe you can shed some light on the question.
Chair Nelson, Representative Nash, the part of your question I thought I heard was whether there's information on compensation paid to a lobbyist. And the answer is no. Through the lobbyist disbursement report, lobbyist never has to disclose the compensation they receive from a particular association for their representation. On the principal report, the principal is required to round in all of the compensation they pay for being represented in Minnesota into a single number. So there's never a breakdown in compensation paid to lobbyists, although there is an overall number that's provided by the association once a year.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, that's all I had.
It's 9:57. Representative Skowski, if you want to wrap up, and we'll lay this over and we'll adjourn the meeting. Mr. Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members and testifiers. And this might not be a bill that becomes law today, but I think it's an area that we as a legislature have to continue to make inquiry. As was brought up and mentioned a number of times, these lobbyists have a great deal of influence here at the Capitol when our constituents are at home working their jobs, trying to get their kids through school, pay their bills, and do the things and live life. They do have the constitutional protections of free speech. This bill is not entitled, or it's not intended to interfere with that. Simply fill out a 5-minute online form that shows where your interests are. I don't think that's interfering. We have two states that I mentioned in my opening that have similar laws. They have not been stricken as unconstitutional at this point. Certainly more exploration in this area I think we need to do. But I very much believe that the interests of the public and the interests of clean, honest, open government outweigh the small amount of extra effort that a lobbyist would have to go through with this bill in order to fill out a statement of economic interest. But thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, and appreciate you hearing the bill today.
Thank you, Representative Skowski. And with that, I'll lay it on the table. And with thanks, it's bringing up a subject that we always should be careful about and be aware of, is making sure there's light and sunlight in what we do here at the Capitol. And with that, members, I'm laying this on the table. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Friday the 25th. We have two bills up. One is Representative Claiborne's bill, and the other is we're hopefully get Representative Freiberg's House File 208 voted on and the amendments voted on and get it out of our committee. With that, members, there are no further questions. We are adjourned.